Hi, Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 12. Continuing on with the Colonial Craftsman series, we're going to talk today about the bookbinder. So really, real bookbinding is done today, much as it was done in the 15th century, but very few people are doing it, unfortunately. And also, very few modern books are really bound the way they used to be. All but a minute number of hardcover books are now cased in covers made separately and held in place by nothing more than glue and string. The weaves of a properly bound book are sewn onto cords, which are tied firmly onto its binding boards. Through the whole colonial period, and for more than almost 30 years after the Revolution, all American books were hand-bound, some well, some quite shoddily. John Saunders started binding books in Boston in 1637, the first one we know to bind books in the colonies. A year before, the first print shop opened. He may have helped to set up the first press. It's possible that he knew more about its operation than the actual printer who started the press, but he was looking for a locksmith by trade. The reason Saunders could start a business before he had books to bind was that he, like his successors, did much rebinding of old volumes. Like him, too, he probably ruled and bound accompt books and kept a stock of writing paper, pen quills, ink, sealing wax, wafers, which were small discs of dry gelatin used to seal folded letters in pre-envelope times, and band boxes that he made himself and covered with decorated paper. The first band boxes held men's bands of collars, and the word was extended later to cover boxes for hats. And interestingly enough, just about a week ago, we saw a shelf go at auction at Book and Pook, with wallpapered boxes, just like what we're talking about, and I think it fetched over $23,000. But keep in mind, most binding was bespoke. A man bought the printed sheets of a book and then had them bound to his taste to match his library, or whatever way his binder's skills, tools, and materials permitted. So, men of means, basically men, unfortunately, at that point, had enough money and they had their own bookbinder that they toted around, and they could tout their library that looked like this or looked like that. So it was almost a way of interior decorating a library with the style of bookbinding on the volumes of books they had in it. But even the 17th century did some edition binding. John Radcliffe came to Boston in 1661, especially to bind the edition of John Eliot's Indian Bible. This was the first Bible printed in North America, but few people have ever learned to read it or seen it or even heard about it. Large 18th century print shops employed binders. They did a lot of cheap work by and large, using thin sheets of wood called scabbard, which could be made here when pasteboard couldn't be, and covering them with paper and sheepskin backstrips. Plain blue paper, probably domestic, was the most commonest, but Dutch gilt, stamped all over with animals or small scenes in gold, was popular, and so was marbled paper. This last was made by floating colors on gum-thickened water and lifting their swirled pattern by dipping a sheet of paper face down in them. Most marble paper came from France, and it was much favored as papers to the line, the binding boards of good books. So the French paper was considered number one in the period. The bookbinder did more than cover a new book, though. He had to forward it also. Forwarding is work done to the pages before the cover is put on. The printer's flat sheets held pages printed on both sides, two to a side for a folio, 4 for a quarto, 8 for octavo. The pages of a folio all stood the same way up on both sides, and a single fold made the big sheet ready to bind. Those of the other sizes were arranged so they would be right side up, with their page numbers on the right order. When the quarto was folded twice, or the octavo 3 times, an apprentice folded them and creased them with a bone blade. Regardless of the number of pages on it, the binder called each folded sheet a signature. His last task was to gather the signatures in their right order. The printer helped by identifying the first page of each one, usually with a letter at the bottom. You can find it in old books even today. To hold the signatures together, the binder sewed them into a series of 5 cords. Few were in cheap books, strung on a sewing frame. The frame stood on the edge of a table. The setup can be seen as early as 1650. The cords are stretched between the top bar and the 5 wooden keys that are held down by the weight of the signatures. The cords of a well-bound book stayed outside the folded backs of the signatures. For cheap bindings with flat spines, the binder sawed shallow trenches across the backs of the cords to lie in, and the cuts showed inside of the book, unfortunately. The cords of such books were sometimes of rawhide. But starting with the lowest signature, the binder ran a needle thread with linen into the edge of the fold about 1/2 inch from the head. The sheets of the book lay piled on the base of the frame with their folded splines facing the binder. The top of the book, called the head, was at his left. Each stitch passed through all the leaves of the signature to its middle. The binder brought his needle out against the upper side of the first cord, went over it and back into the fold on its lower side. He continued this around each cord and brought his needle out beyond the last one, 1/2 inch from the bottom, which is the tail. He went into the next signature at the same point and worked back the other way, tying his thread to the loose end at the head. At the tail of his 3rd signature, and before he started on the 4th, he caught a kettle stitch, which is a catch-up stitch, around the short hitch that connected the 1st 2. He then repeated this kettle stitch on both ends until the whole book was sewn. The binder placed the sewn book with its back flat and square between 2 stiff boards and clamped it, front edge up, in his horizontal trimming press. 2 strips on the upper surface of the press guided his plow as its sharp tip trimmed the leaves to evenness. After each 3 or 4 passes, he gave a turn of the plow's long wooden screws and moved the cutter forward a little at a time. Finally, it met the board on the far side, where it projected slightly above the surface of the press. A good book press needed a round back, so the binder turned it over and put an angled backing board on each side and clamped it in a laying press with the spine standing a little above the boards. He then carefully backed the spine by hammering it to the roundness, bending each signature away from the middle. A flat back can cave in and cause the front edge of the leaves to bulge forward, though. One purpose of the hard cover is to protect the edges of the leaves, so the craftsman cut the 2 pasteboard blanks for a little oversize just used the cords to fasten them on. He made a row of holes down the back edge of each board, 1 hole directly opposite each cord, and notched to the edge of the board, so the cord could reach the hole without making a hump on the cover. A 2nd hole for each cord went alongside the 1st one. The binder threaded a cord into its 1st hole from the outside and brought it back out through the 2nd hole. There he spread its frayed end flat on the board and glued it down. Repeating this on both ends of each cord, he tied every part of the book into a unit, which years' use would then help not to separate it out. The remaining work was ornamental. First came the head and the tail bands at the ends of the spine. Small strips of leather covered with two colors of bright silk thread overcast and anchored in the kettle stitches. Only the edges of the bands would show now. Then the thin leather cover, imported Morocco, which was the best, calf, next best, and most used, which was sheep, was not really good enough for fine work. And this was all cut. It didn't matter which of the three coverings was cut 3/4 of an inch larger than the boards themselves. The binder thinned its edges with a shaving knife and drew it on, wet with paste and then on the inside. He pressed his leather close over the hammered spine, working it against the cords and stretching it a little over them, so that they showed as neat projecting welts called bands. The front and back he smoothed flat, turning the leather over the edges in the neatest manner. As he advertised, and pasting to overlap to the inside of the board, the end papers he cut to the size of 2 pages and passed 1/2 against the inside face of the other cover, hiding the edges of the leather itself. Then he stood the front edge on the shape blocks and tied the book up with string, blocks and all, to let the paste dry. The work now needed a few days between boards in a big standing press to dry out thoroughly and flatten. But even the simplest binding required a title on its spine to identify it on a shelf and to indicate its top. Almost universally, 18th century binders stamped titles in gold on small rectangles of thin, dark leather, which would have been black, red, green, or blue. They glued this patch on the spine to fill the space between the top band and the next one below it. Quite often the binder went further and ornamented the leather with tooling, on the spine only or both it and with the front cover. He did this, as binders still do, with heated brass tools pressed hard onto the leather. The tools had 2 forms. The palette, its handle perpendicular to its flat face, which was engraved with a raised letter or with 1 or more straight lines or various rolls or features within the roll. This was the disc. This was a disc rotatable at the end of the long handle on which it was mounted, much as a wheelwright's traveler was. The edge of the roll yielded either filigree borders or merely straight lines. In the latter case, it was known as a fillet and was matched to permit making neat covers. It took great skill to press a border onto a cover with rolls, to run each course perfectly straight by gauging against the left thumbnail, and stop and start at the right points. Old books show that skilled workers sometimes slipped. When colonial binders used gold in their tooling, they almost always confined it to the spine, where it'd make a display in the bookcase, and where it could be applied with palettes. It was hard enough to put those on, but the pattern had to be applied blind first, using only the hot tool, then precisely painted with glaire, which is egg white and water, kind of a sizing, then covered with clips of gold leaf, and stamped over again with the same hot tool and in exactly the same place. That's the difficulty. The glare and the pressure made the gold stick. Any that lay beyond the pattern would just be brushed off and wouldn't adhere, which was a good thing. Tooling on very early American books was simple. Lines across the spine of both sides of each band and to fill it across the margins of the cover. The fillet lines crossed at the corners to avoid the stopping problem. This was was all left blind. But after 1700, front covers acquired double panels in their centers and a little filigree. Still blind, and spines took on panels outlined in gold between the bands. So with a gold rosette sometimes stamped in the center of each. So by 1782, Robert Aiken of Philadelphia printed the two volumes of the first complete American Bible in English. He bound some copies of it by himself, handsomely. His own copy still survives, covered in soft green morocco with a neat gold border on the covers and with the panels of the spine enriched with gold flowers and leaves. It wasn't quite unusual for printers to bind books. William Parks, who printed in Annapolis and in Williamsburg somewhere around 1730, was a binder. James Franklin, and we know who he was in Boston, his brother Benjamin in Philadelphia, and William Goddard in Baltimore and New York, were all printers, and they could also bind books. Franklin, Benjamin, bound books also. From 1800 to around 1840, American publishing boomed. Printing was still handwork, but the printers met the demand by multiplying presses and men. Binding, too, was still handwork, and it caused a bottleneck. At first, the books were solid in bare boards, but sometimes, and somewhere in the 1820s, the cloth-covered case binding, made as a unit in advance and simply glued to the spine, solved this problem. Its making and application were still handwork, but both could be done by semi-skilled labor, so the decrease of the quality of books declined in that first quarter of the 19th century. And in an effort to relieve the supposed commonplace appearance of cloth, the publishers resorted to the arming press, which, by squeezing a book-sized plate on a cover, embossed its whole surface with an elaborate pattern. Some books were still bound in leather in the early 1800s, but because skins had began to become tanned with mineral salts instead of tan bark and sumac, they didn't hold up quite as well, so books bound then were usually in worse shape than those which were much, much older, even 150 years older. So, again, the decrease in quality. So that kind of wraps us up with the our episode here on the bookbinder. A lot of good information, I think, about the 18th century. Greg Perry, the historic preservationist, I'll sign out and remind everyone, if you have any other interest, you could follow us on the Instagram, the Historic Preservationist, all lowercase, all one word, which leads to the IGTV, which is about 15-minute videos. These videos, like our YouTube videos, you can find us in the Horological Conservation Workshop, the Furniture Restoration Shop, or our Architectural Mill. So please pass it on and hit the subscribe button. Greg Perry, signing out. Thanks for listening.